Inside the Friendly Confines with Jesse Rogers, presented by Arlington Toyota. Looking for a smart play on your next vehicle? Arlington Toyota delivers with a full lineup of dependable cars, SUVs, and trucks ready for Chicago drivers. The same trusted team you've known for years is now backed by new ownership from the Andy Moore Auto Group, bringing even more value every day. Visit ToyotaArlington.com today.
Welcome to Inside the Friendly Confines with Jesse Rogers, a Cubs-centric podcast brought to you by Good Karma Brands, ESPN 1000, and of course our friends at Arlington Toyota. Good to be back with you after the All-Star break. Hope you had a good week. I got to follow PCA around at the game in Philadelphia. He was pretty popular. It was kind of funny. I feel like he was asked this every day, even a couple times by myself. He was asked if he'd participate in Home Run Derby next summer at Wrigley Field. And every day he inched closer to saying yes. Eventually, he just basically committed to it, saying if Cub fans want him to participate, he will. Well, what do you think? Of course they do. And of course he's going to do it if, in fact, we have an All-Star game next summer. We've got this labor issue looming. That's something I had to cover at the All-Star game for ESPN.com as well. We'll address all of that in future episodes, but you know the deal by now. One side wants a salary cap, the other does not. Until one or the other gives in, we're going to be in this stalemate, and that's probably going to last quite a while. But again, that's for another day. Today, we're going to do our part in the 2016 reunion tour. What a weekend it was at Wrigley Field. Coming up in a few minutes, I'm going to welcome first base coach from that era, Brandon Hyde, to the podcast. Of course, the former manager for the Baltimore Orioles. He was here over the weekend for the unveiling of championship gateway, and of course he was heavily involved in that championship from the first base coach's box, and did so much with those players before moving on to Baltimore. So we'll go down memory lane with Brandon Hyde. Great to see all those guys. I mean, I covered that team as a reporter. I went to 80 road games a bunch of years in a row, all the spring training games, the playoff games. It was a career highlight for me. I mean, that team was so much fun to cover, and they were so good at the game of baseball, right? You've probably seen and heard a lot of the coverage already, but I wanted to play this one clip from Theo Epstein. It was great to see him, covered him for all those years, then haven't talked to him in a while. He was asked if he would still be around as the guy in charge if they hadn't broken that 108-year curse. I mean, I love this story. Here's Theo Epstein.
Well, I wouldn't have left voluntarily. I don't know. But, yeah, no, it's funny. He asked earlier, like, when what was that moment when you, kind of sunk in or whatever. For me, I would, along the way, up until October or November 2016, I would wake up from time to time with this dream, just having lived through an awesome dream that we won the World Series with the Cubs and, you know, we're about getting ready to go to the parade and everything. And then I'd wake up and be like, oh, shit. We're still building this thing. We're still rebuilding. Or we just got swept by the Mets. Or it hasn't happened yet. And it was such a letdown every morning when reality took over.
Yep, that was reoccurring?
Yeah, that was reoccurring. And then the morning when we got back from Cleveland and, you know, we all took a nap and I woke up again with that same feeling, like, oh, yeah, we did it. And I'm like, oh, shit, wait, was this a dream? No, this is real. And that's when it sunk in for me. I'm like, it just felt like liberation.
Man, it was even haunting him in his dreams. That 108-year wait was certainly heavy on everyone, including him. So I'll get to more on that with Brandon Hyde in just a moment. Later this week, by the way, we'll do a mailbag segment with your questions. I'm sure they're piling up since the All-Star break and with the trade deadline looming soon. Producer Jack McGrath, where can people leave a question?
Yeah, just leave them in the YouTube comments. So super easy. If you're watching on YouTube right now, drop them in the comments. I go through those before every episode. Or if not there, you can leave them on Twitter as well. Just tag me at Jack McGrath 1000 on Twitter, and I'll be able to read all the questions there and then read them to you, Jesse.
All right. Thank you, Jack. Before we get to Brandon Hyde, let's throw the first pitch. All right, we can't just go down memory lane on this episode. The second half has begun. Cubs had a nice series against the Twins, which included a couple of big run-scoring days. Sunday was great, obviously, scoring 10 runs, but I actually liked Saturday even better. They scored six with their leadoff hitter, Best, 0 for 5, and their number four hitter, Alex Bregman, going 0 for 4, but yet they scored 6 and won the game. It was the bottom of the order that did a lot of damage. And make no mistake, that really is the path for this team. It has been to this point and will continue to be. It's length over slug. It's length over one or two guys carrying them. In fact, I asked Craig Counsell about it after the game. Here's what he had to say.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think we talked a lot. This is hopefully the strength of our offense is that we can score throughout the lineup and we can produce offense kind of every inning because there's you know, our you know, Dansby, who hits ninth, has, I think, almost 60 RBIs. And that's a sign, I think, that we can do that. And we need to be able to do that because we shouldn't – it can't be Pete every day. And – you know, it can't be Say every day. So getting production from all parts of the lineup is really important for this team.
So, yeah, as I've said, that's the avenue. It's not one or two guys slugging this team to victory. The problem, of course, comes when you face really good pitching. It's hard to get the 3, 4, 5 hits in an inning or in multiple innings. So having that guy in the middle helps. They just don't necessarily have it unless, say, Suzuki's really hot in the middle of that order. So let's see if this length in this lineup can continue to win them games and get them to the playoffs. Of course, they didn't really make up any ground. They didn't, in fact, on the Brewers over the weekend because they never lose. They never lose. By the way, if you're a Cub fan, you need to be asking Marlins manager Clayton McCullough this question. How the heck is Pete Fairbanks closing in a 1-0 game in Milwaukee on Sunday to avoid a sweep when he has a 6.60 ERA? That was before he got shelled. That ERA went up after William Contreras hit a walk-off 3-run homer. Can you imagine Craig Counsell putting in a guy with a 6.60 ERA in a 1-0 game to avoid a sweep? The criticism he would get. In any case, Milwaukee continues to maintain that nice 5-6 game lead. We'll see if the Cubs can cut into it before the trade deadline. As we turn the page to that trade deadline, I'll have more on that in the next episode and certainly next week. But as we tape this on Monday afternoon before the Cubs host the Tigers, Jameson Taillon is back from injury. That's an important update there. Edward Cabrera should be back right around August 1st. Hoping Ben Brown sometime in early August, though. So there is some hope for that walking wounded. And that leads me to my thought on the deadline. It's that the Cubs do have numbers to fill out in the rotation now down the stretch, assuming everyone's healthy. So the question isn't about the numbers. It's not about the quantity. It's about the quality. And do they have a deal in them to find a pitcher that sort of meets that threshold of better than what we have? Now, they're playing the Tigers. If Tarek Skubal is available, he is certainly better than what they have. But I don't think there's a lot out there that is automatically better than what they have. Now, one of the issues with the Cubs, of course, is Shota Inamanaga can look great and can be just okay at times. It looks like Matthew Boyd is back to the old Matthew Boyd, so that's good news. But we know Taillon, for example, can look good and can look bad. And there's a few other guys like that. But you know what? So can Robbie Ray. So can Freddie Peralta. So I'm not sure, outside of Joe Ryan, you know, Sonny Gray, but he's probably not getting traded, and Tarek Skubal, there's absolutely a guy that's better than what they have. They need to look to the back end of the bullpen. They've pieced this thing together pretty well, but without a lot of October or even late September experience, they need to address potentially the ninth inning, even as well as Jacob Webb has done. And why is that? Well, here's Craig Counsell on the most important injury update he gave on Friday. It's about Daniel Palencia.
Palencia is in Arizona. He went to Arizona for the All-Star break and stayed down there. We're making progress with Daniel. We're kind of not moving forward. So he's not, we're just having to repeat some steps so far. So it's, you know, the original timetable of early August has been pushed back to probably mid-August right now. Assuming we move forward from here.
Okay. Now, wait a minute, Jack, I think I need to hear that again. He said making progress, but not moving forward. In the matter of 2 seconds, he said those two things. Making progress, but not moving forward. Let's hear that again.
Palencia is in Arizona. He went to Arizona for the All-Star break and stayed down there.
we're making progress with Daniel. We're kind of not moving forward. So he's not. We're just having to repeat some steps so far. So it's, you know, the original timetable of early August has been pushed back to probably mid-August right now, assuming we move forward from here.
Okay, anyway, back-end reliever, that's who I think they need to get. Someone they didn't get last year, they got middle guys. They need a back-end guy. Easier said than done. There's not as many available that are having good years. I mean, if you can get Mason Miller, go get him. I like Louis Varland on Toronto, but he's got years of team control, so that's a bigger deal than just for a rental. We'll see what the next 10 days brings us in terms of the trade deadline. But I'm thinking back-end relievers more than starters, as long as the walking wounded does, in fact, return. All right, let's go inside the clubhouse with former first base coach Brandon Hyde.
Inside the Friendly Confines with Jesse Rogers, presented by Arlington Toyota. Looking for a smart play on your next vehicle? Arlington Toyota delivers with a full lineup of dependable cars, SUVs, and trucks ready for Chicago drivers. The same trusted team you've known for years is now backed by new ownership from the Andy Moore Auto Group, bringing even more value every day. Visit ToyotaArlington.com today.
All right, let's welcome in the first base coach from that championship team. It's Brandon Hyde, who happens to be in Cleveland, where they won it all. You really had to relive it all, Brandon, huh? Be in Chicago over the week and then get to Cleveland where you guys clinched. Or you're doing some work there, I assume.
No, I'm doing some work here, yeah. So I'm doing some trade deadline stuff and for the Tampa Bay Rays this year and enjoying it. But Cleveland's got definitely a special place in my heart.
For sure. I'm glad you got out of Chicago with your liver intact, because those guys were having some fun. Take me through the day on Saturday. They unveil a championship gateway there, the plaques, the whole experience at Wrigley Field, and obviously picking it up with your old coaches and players there as well.
Yeah, it's been 10 years, but honestly, when you get around everybody, it doesn't seem that long ago. And awesome. You know, we had one in January also, so got to see a lot of those guys. And, I've been in the league for a while since then. So be able to see, you know, I saw Riz in the AL East when he was with the Yankees all too many times, managed against Joe in Anaheim. So obviously been seeing a lot of people, but a lot of guys that you hadn't seen in 10 years. And it felt like we just picked up where we left off. The funnest team that I've ever been a part of by far. An amazing group of people, and Saturday was a blast.
Yeah, and what the other thing that picked up where it left off was the love affair with Chicago. The fans the current team, if they want to know how much love you can feel if you win a champion, I asked Matthew Boyd this. I mean, 10 years from now, Matthew Boyd, how much would you love to come back and be that guy like those guys were? Because Wrigley Field just, in that Wrigleyville area, of course, I assume you could feel the love just like the players.
For sure. That was the first Cubs game I've ever been to as a not on the field. So we sat in the bleachers, to get the fan experience, and the fans were, obviously they loved the players and coaches and front office so much from that time period. Tom was sitting a couple rows back for a little while. Just to get that experience with, you know, drinking beer in the bleachers on a really hot summer day. It's hard to pay attention to the game. Me and Hinsky were like, the fourth thing. I'm like, I don't know if I've seen anything yet besides the homer to right. But it's because it's a party. I mean, it's just such a great experience. You can see why they love the team. You can see why everybody loves going to Wrigley. But sitting in the bleachers out there on Saturday was a lot of fun.
I don't know whose idea was it. I'll give Big Jim credit, because he worked so hard on this. But you guys sitting in the bleachers was a brilliant idea. And now you know what my childhood was like. I grew up in Chicago. It's fun out there, isn't it?
Oh, my God. Yeah. No, I would have, our friends, I lived in Evanston during those years. So if we had friends that go to the game and talk about their bleacher experiences and coaching first base, I wasn't that far from it. You could hear and you could see and you could – it looks like they're having a ton of fun out there, and to be able to experience it this past weekend was that was a blast.
Let's go back 10 years, because I bet the memory started coming back when you started seeing people. You were the first base coach during that era. I was covering the team. It really was like the Rolling Stones on the road. I mean, the fans just could not get enough of this team that started out 25-6. And here's the thing I remember early on, and I think Chris Bryant said this maybe on day two of spring training, 2016 was going to be a continuation of 2015. It really did feel like 2 years connected. Did that feel like that to you as well?
It did, for sure. I think, you know, 2015, when we kind of, you know, our guys just kind of came out of nowhere a little bit, and I think shocked kind of the baseball world. We won 97 games. I've listened to a lot of the podcast, you know, Riz's stuff, you know, talking to the guys. It brings back a lot of great memories. But that Pittsburgh game was obviously an exclamation point to the league of these guys have arrived. And we just kind of rolled that into the 16 spring training, because that championship series against the Mets was so devastating. You know, to run in against Syndergaard, DeGrom, Harvey, the way we did, and how hot those guys were. You know, I thought we were going to the World Series. I thought we were winning it that year. I felt so good after the Cardinals series that after that 15 series, it leaves a taste in your mouth we want to get back here. And then the offseason moves that Theo made, that, you know, that offseason, just incredible to really bolster an already really good playoff team. We went rolling into 16 thinking that we had the best team in the game.
Yeah, remember, you went 7-0 against the Mets during the regular season in 15. So it's probably another reason why you think, oh, we can beat these guys. But the playoffs are another animal. And I'm guessing, you know, you had to go through 15 to get through 16. Like, you got to experience some struggles to understand what it takes to win. But that 25-6 start just, you know, gave everyone so much confidence, I think, that the whole city. And even with Schwarber going down, you didn't really lose a beat. What was it like on a daily basis? Because it sounded like it was a circus, yet there was so much talent that once that first pitch was thrown at 7 o'clock, everybody was ready to rock and roll.
I just remember, it was just fun, honestly. Yeah. I mean, there was, when the game would start, you didn't feel like we were ever going to lose. How I felt. I felt going, showing up to the ballpark that we were going to win every single game. You know, we had an incredible, you know, rotation that stayed healthy, and Joe did an amazing job of keeping those guys healthy. And so you felt like you were going to win every single night with the five guys that we were throwing out there. And then our offense was just so dynamic and so dangerous, and we could score runs from every part of the order. You to get through the first four guys with the way they took those at bats with Fuller, with Dexter and KB and Riz and Zoe. Just four super professional at bats to start. And then you had all these guys that were so dangerous at the second half of the order, and the Monteros and Soler and Russell and Javi and Contreras in the second half, and all these guys that are now, you know, superstar type players, all-star players. We were loaded with all-star players throughout that just made it so hard. I remember some pitching coaches on the other side that I knew, like, we can't, to game plan against you guys was just impossible, because there was no windows, there was no openings for guys to be able to navigate through. And that's how you felt. That's how we felt. That's how I felt on coaching first base. I felt like, oh my God, we're going to score every inning. And I never felt like we were going to lose the game. And on top of that, the quality of the people that we had and how they're just such great characters and how much fun they were. That was just, we just had a blast.
Made my job a lot easier. Trust me. Made my job a lot easier.
A lot of characters.
Yeah, a lot of things to write about. And that feeling of it feels like we're never going to lose. I mean, that's a once in a lifetime feeling in this game, right? I mean, if you're lucky, I mean, Baltimore, you were really good with Baltimore for a while. I'm not sure you had that feeling like we're never going to lose. That's a once in a generational feeling on a team, I feel like.
Well, it starts with the rotation, you know, and with Lester and Arrieta, like, and then Kyle with a 2 ERA, and John Lackey, who's the biggest competitor of all time, and Jason Hamill, who was so good. So you roll those five guys out there, you feel like you're going to, you show up, you feel like you're going to win the game.
Yeah.
And you did. And we did a lot. And then getting Chappie after the trade deadline just cemented the fact of what our front office, you know, how aggressive our guys were being. That's a massive impact on the club. That was a statement that our front office gave to our players of, you know, we totally believe in you guys. Here's another piece of just, and Chappie obviously showed up huge for us.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I don't have Hector Rondon's numbers in front of me. He was not bad. This was not a guy losing his gig. And a lot of times, even if you have good numbers, if you're bad at the near the deadline, they might, you know, replace you. He wasn't even bad near the deadline. They just said, no, we just want to lock this thing down completely from the seventh inning on, because you were getting 6 to 7 innings out of your starter. So really, it was just even 2 innings. And Chapman allowed you to do that. I want to go back to one other thing, because I know you've talked about learning so much from Joe Maddon, but this idea of embracing the target, that phrase alone, I think was the single best non sort of baseball thing he ever did with that team. Because as I mentioned, Brandon, I grew up in this city, the weight of the 100 years, 101 years, 102 years, every single time the Cubs were favored in my lifetime, except for maybe 2008, they way underachieved. And this was ripe for that to happen after 15. And he diffused it all by saying, no, we know we're good. We know you think we're good. We're going to live up to it. I thought it was brilliant.
It was the magic of Joe, honestly. I just going back to the Chapman thing just before.
Oh, yeah.
Chappie was the, for our, with Theo and Jed and J-Mac and those guys, that was their, that was because of their World Series and postseason experience. And that's why you know that you have to have, and Hector was good, and Stroppe was the best right on right guy in the game with the slider. Mm-hmm. But understanding what postseason baseball was like and going to get somebody printed, that was their experience allowing for that to happen for us. So I give a ton of credit for those guys. That doesn't happen all the time. With Joe, Joe took all the pressure off the players.
Yeah.
He made it so this was just an American Legion game in the summertime when you're 14 years old. And that's the atmosphere we had. It was we were very professional. Our guys showed up to play. They played hard. We were prepared. But there was a looseness, and Joe allowed that he wanted guys to – he liked characters. He liked guys to be themselves. He liked personality. He liked shenanigans. He liked all that stuff. And that group of players really took to it. But Joe saying the things of talking about taking pressure off and talking about embracing the target and all those type of things, that was his way of saying, listen, we're really, really good. And nobody's going to care. We're going to do things without anybody caring what we're doing. And, he was a master at that.
Yeah. It was a brilliant move to loosen things up, because the weight of it can crater you. It can. I've seen it happen before. It doesn't matter how much talent you have. You have to keep it loose and play as a team and all these things and be ready to rock and roll at 7 o'clock. You know, I could talk about every individual on that team. It's unfortunate guys like KB and Javi couldn't be there, you know, over the weekend or in January. They're employed by other teams, you know, and it's too bad. You know, Javi should be here this week in Chicago because the Tigers are here, but he's hurt. But what was it like just around some of the talent? I mean, when Javi got to first base, did you have to do much coaching, or maybe you did have to do a lot of coaching? I don't know.
Not with Javi. You just want Javi. Javi might be the most instinctual base runner I've ever been around. You want Javi to be Javi out there. And it's why you saw the, you know, big plays at third with the pick behind, and he's scoring in the postseason, all those things. Those were all instinctual. But that's not coaching. And I saw it, but I saw Javi when he was an A-ball. I was with Javi in 2012 in extended spring training. So you saw all those base running instincts. You just had to try to hone things in with him a little bit, give him a routine, try to shorten his swing up a little bit, try to just have him understand being a professional. And as he grew, the confidence was always there with him, the great personality, that how he played hard, all that stuff was always in there. And then it just became doing it at the major league level. And Joe was an imperfect manager for Javi too, because he let Javi be Javi. He let Javi play with instincts. He moved Javi around defensively. John Lester's on the mound with the cutter with righties. Javi was playing third base. He would do certain things with Javi. And then Javi took to that and he liked it and he didn't want to feel restricted. And so I feel like we got, you know, Joe probably got the most out of him in those early years in his career.
For sure. You know, it reminds me of something Jay Hay told me, taking nothing away from anybody else on the roster. But he used to tell me himself, Rizzo, and Baez, he'd like to think we're playing on a different level instinctually. Mm-hmm. They just were a step ahead, taking, again, nothing away from anyone else. Would you agree that trio? Maybe there was more, but I remember him telling me, Rizzo, Baez, and I just have a thing in the field, especially, or on the bases, that we kind of know one step ahead of others.
There was so much talent on that team, right? So you could argue that Jay Hayes has been the best defensive right fielder in the past however many years. He would literally shut down one side of an outfield just because of his Inspector Gadget arms and making plays in the gap and making plays toward the line, always being in the right place. I did outfield positioning, never had to worry about Jay Hay. Jay was going to be, whether he was 0-4 or 4-4, he was going to be locked in defensively and totally shut down one side of the field. And Riz is a superstar. I mean, Riz was one of the most clutch players, professional, gold glove winner, defender, constantly communicating. If you watch those three guys especially, constantly communicating on defense. And then you had Zobrist, who's the most, you know, biggest pro of all time. And, you know, Dexter would communicate. There was guys that knew how to play the game, that liked to play with each other, that were constantly talking on defense. And not only that, their talent level was exceptional. And on top of all that, me and Hinsky were talking during the game. It's unusual how big these guys were. If you looked at the roster, the physicality on our team, is incredible. Not just the rotation with Lack and Lester and Hamill and those guys, how big those guys were, but like Jay Hay's a mountain of a man. Jorge Soler is 6'4", 240. You know, Riz is massive. KB's 6'5". Dexter's 6'4". Like the size of that on that team was incredible. Javi Baez was probably one of the smallest guy on the team, and he's built like a boxer. So they're physically so talented, and then couple that with great makeup. And so that's why it just became a special, special group.
I'm so glad you brought up size, Brandon, because on this podcast, and I've been doing this for a couple months, and certainly on the radio over the years, I always mention how size is kind of not talked about enough. Size on the mound, especially, like, I want my pitchers big and strong. I remember in the late 90s, like I was early in my career, walking into the Yankees clubhouse, and I was like, oh my God, Mariano Rivera is built. He's the closer, for God's sakes. Derek Jeter's the shortstop. It's not talked about enough. In fact, I've been a little critical of Jed's current team. I feel like it's a little undersized. Now, they do other things well. When you're undersized, that means you're a little quicker, and they play great defense, but they don't have like the big, big, strong guys. But that 16 team certainly did. I was thinking of Baez on the base pass. The one negative was when Wilson Contreras would get to first, he thought he was Javi Baez, right? And I want to ask you about him, Ross, and Miguel Montero. Now, I know you weren't the catching guy, but you talk about three different personalities that Joe and Borzello and these guys had at Corral. I wrote a story about those three catchers appearing in the World Series in Game 7. Like, that's a whole other dynamic, getting three catchers to do what is needed behind the plate and check your egos. And that wasn't easy with those three, in my opinion.
In the big leagues, being able to check your ego at the door and you're playing a role. And those three guys played the role to the utmost, a total winning role. Those three guys were so important. When Willie got there, and Miggy and Rossi knew how talented Willie was and what he was doing in the minor leagues and what he could add to our team. And to Joe Maddon's credit, and to why make Joe so good. If you don't remember, like, Willie played a little bit of left. I remember him playing left in Cincinnati. He would take ground balls at first. Willie signed as a third baseman originally out of Venezuela. So Joe was using him in different ways too, to keep his bat in the lineup. Rossi and Miggy did an incredible job of supporting him. Were ready when their name was called. Rossi obviously had the every single Lester start. Miggy would be sharing some other starts with Willie. But the way those three guys operated, they always knew that they were ready to pinch it. They were always ready to pinch it off the bench. Both Miggy and Rossi always sat right next to me, especially at home and they were super prepared all the time because those two guys just wanted to win. And that was their whole mentality. And that's why they're great, great leaders, both those guys, just incredible leaders on a team that had amazing veteran guys and really, really talented young guys. Those two guys were a huge, huge part of that club.
I'm curious if you remember any bumpy moments. There were so few. I wonder if they stand out. Mm-hmm. You did have a stretch June into July, I think. But in general, did it get bumpy at all in that clubhouse? Were there some clashes, or just when things weren't going well on the field? What went on behind the scenes a little bit? Do you remember anything?
I don't remember hardly any clashing. I think we stumbled a little bit into the All-Star break. I remember that. And I just think our guys were kind of ready for the All-Star break. I think that we had won so many and so many games, and we're just kind of trying to get to the break, and we had such a big lead. I think that was a little just kind of a normal, stumble into a 6-month season. The adversity, the Schwarber thing was how we came out of that Schwarber thing. That was massive, because that was heartbreaking. And that, that night, I just remember feeling sick to my stomach because we were so excited for Schwarber to be healthy and be out there and be a huge part of our lineup. And then for him to knowing that he's going to miss the rest of the year. But to our guys' credit, Theo and those guys' credit, the depth that they went and got in the offseason, getting Jay Hay, we had Soler there. Soler had 50 homers in Kansas City a couple of years later. Like we had other pieces that could pick up Schwarber's loss. And but I don't remember many tough times, just until the postseason, when there was a couple of those games going into the games where we really need to win tonight. After the offense kind of falling asleep in LA first couple games of that series, the game five in Chicago was obviously in the World Series was obviously the biggest game, because 3 and 4 didn't go the way we wanted to. So those were some nerve wracking moments. But that team was so close that there was hardly any off the field issues.
Yeah, down 3-1, was there still confidence? I imagine so, but was it faltering at all in the Cleveland series?
You felt good about Lester being on the mound, and you felt good, really good about Arrieta going game six. So we felt like we had two of the best starters in the game going these two next games. And then, Kyle had a 2 ERA that year going for us in game seven. So it was really, you just had so much faith in John and Jake to kind of get us to game seven. KB for me got the biggest, both those games, the massive hits. The homers in both those games really took the pressure off. What Chappie did in game five is legendary, should be legendary in the city of Chicago, to have a one inning closer go 2+ innings out of the pen to get us to a game six. There was doubt. I don't want the season to be over, but you do have so much confidence in those starters that you felt like if we could just score a few and we can keep this thing going.
To bring it back full circle as we start to wrap up here, Brandon, I appreciate it. It's too bad KB couldn't come back to feel that love, because obviously he's fallen on some tough times. This back injury has really been tough, and he's still employed by the Rockies, obviously. He's talked openly about how bad he feels that he's not earning his paycheck there, but he certainly earned it in Chicago. And, boy, that 4-year run from college player of the year, minor league player of the year, rookie of the year, and MVP, I'm not sure we're going to see. PCA is good, but this guy was even better if you can go back to his time being drafted and getting to the major leagues.
Yeah, he was, in my opinion, he was the best player in the league in 16. Yeah. And he's such a really good player. Just not only the power, but the ability to run. For someone in that size, the ability to score from first on a double, he scored from first in the game seven on a ball that didn't even get to the wall. His base running, his whole game was exceptional. It wasn't just a third baseman that's hit for some power with a good arm. It was KB was a totally complete player that took walks, and was engaged defensively. That was a great, great base runner that could play anywhere on the field. And not to mention he could flip a ball out of the ballpark with ease, right? So it was he was the best player in the league for me in 16, and I did see him a couple years ago when we played the Rockies and we talked for a while, and I love KB. It's just such an incredible person, and I'm hoping that he can rebound from this and finish his career the right way, because the start of his career was something like I'd never seen before.
Last thing, going back to Saturday, the players had their thing, but coaches and a manager, there's a certain bond there. What was it like seeing Hinsky and Joe and everybody? I know you've seen him in the past, but all in one place, not just those guys. There were others on the staff that people don't talk about. Just go back to Saturday and seeing everybody, and what stood out to you?
I hadn't seen Lester Strode in I don't think since 17 or 18. So
great guy.
And looks younger. Unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable how in shape he is and how great he looked. And yeah, our coaching staff was very, very close. That was a character group in the coaching staff as well. So the two hitting guys with Males and Hinsky, Franklin Font, incredible person. The pitching side with Borzy and Boz and Tommy Hotovy, obviously he's there now, been there for a while as our game plan guy. Nate Hom, who I took to Baltimore, was a game plan guy there in Baltimore for me.
Mm-hmm.
But Gary Jones, just an incredible baseball man and a great third base coach, a great coach, period, just a baseball lifer. Davey, great to see Davey. Me and Davey have had some battles with Washington and Baltimore over the past handful of years. Mm-hmm. So great to see Davey again, and Joe at the top. I mean, Joe, my biggest mentor to this point of what he's meant for me and my family and everything that he's done.
I'm so glad they let him speak. He's such a good public speaker, and I know you could have gone to Theo, gone this guy, but. I thought Joe needed to be the guy to talk in front of that, championships gateway. So, so cool, Brandon, to go down memory lane. It feels like it was yesterday in some ways, but then I feel like you and I have probably aged 10 years because this game will do it to you. Cool. I know you had a good run in Baltimore, and who knows, maybe you get a ring in Tampa. You got a good team there, huh?
It's a good team. Yep. It's a good team. It's a really good pitching staff. We're hoping to add a little bit and hopefully we can make a run.
Absolutely. Thanks for doing this. See you down the road, Brandon.
Okay, Jesse. Thanks.
All right. That's Brandon Hyde, former first base coach of the championship Cubs from 2016.